Be together again. Numbers chapter 14 is where we're at this morning. And I want to just jump into this verse and then we'll give a little explanation. Numbers chapter 14 and go right to verse 22. Right to verse 22. Because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have tempted me now these 10 times, and have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoked me see it. These 10 times they have provoked me. As we've been going through stories our children should know, we come up to the time of Israel, and as I thought about it, I thought, you know, it may seem as we go through the stories of Israel that you hit a lot of the same things because it was they kept complaining and they kept disobeying the Lord. And it may seem kind of monotonous. Oh, Pastor, we're hearing the story again. We kind of already learned that lesson. So I thought, not that we won't touch on certain things in the future, but to address them to somewhat compactly and to realize these problems that the children of Israel were having, the sins that they were committing, that are referenced now in Numbers chapter 14 as they come up to the promised land finally. And we'll come back to this point in a moment, but they refuse. Don't believe. They lack faith. And God says, all these people that saw my miracles and have tempted me now, interesting, these 10 times. I wondered a while back as I saw that, I wonder if you could look back in Scripture and actually find 10 accounts where they tempted the Lord. Does the Bible actually record those? And I did a study and feel that I did come up with 10. Now, whether these are exactly the 10 he was describing, I'm not for sure, but we'll look at them this morning. The people of Israel were a good picture of humanity, weren't they? A good slice of humanity that sees God and yet can respond so carnally. And time again can murmur and complain and come out with these problems. Have you ever felt like you're coming back to God and saying, yeah, it's me again? I remember when I was a kid in a small country church in northern Indiana, there was a man and an elderly man and his wife, and they would sing regularly. They were the staple of our special music. I don't know that we really had much special music other than them. We had a little bit. But it seemed like almost every week, Marvin and Olene sang. He'd get up and he'd bring his 12-string guitar and he'd play and she'd sing the alto next to him. And they did a nice job. And I remember a song that they sang on the chorus said, "It's me again, Lord. I've got a prayer that needs an answer. It's me again, Lord. I've got a problem I can't solve." And that phrase, "It's me again, Lord," I remember as a young man struggling with a particular sin, and I felt like that. It's me again, God. I've come to you 100, maybe 1,000 times for this problem, and I'm here again, seeking your cleansing, your victory, your help. It's me again, Lord. And in some ways, we may feel that same way with the people of Israel, that yep, we're back at the same problem, the same sinfulness, the same struggle, the same disbelief. It's me again, Lord. It's them again, Lord. He uses in the text of Numbers chapter 14, he says, because all those men which saw my miracles, etc., have tempted me now these 10 times. Tempted. The Hebrew word under consideration means to prove, if you will. When David said, I'll fight the giant, and Saul said, "Here, use my armor." And it says he proved his armor. He tested it. He probably did, maybe he did some motions and he walked around a little bit in it, and he said, "This just doesn't fit. It's not me. I'm not used to it. It's not made for me." He proved it. He tested it. It is that idea of to test and to tempt, we might say, but not in the sense in this context of seduction. It's not to say that God was really struggling with sinning at this moment. When we say, "Wow, I'm really tempted," God wasn't being tempted in that way. He was being tested. Okay? When we use similar terminology, we say, you're really testing my patience. One of the integral parts of education, right, is not just the dissemination of information, but at some point the teacher will give a test. And hopefully not just to see if you recall facts, but to see your ability to apply those facts to certain situations. Math would be an excellent illustration there, that you know certain rules, you know certain theorem, you know certain facts, and then as you come to a test, you see a brand new equation that you've never seen before. You see a new problem, a new dimension to find and a problem to solve. And you have to see whether you can take the facts that you know and appropriately apply them to the problem here to solve. That's the idea of testing. And in James chapter 1, hold your place here, but in James chapter 1, he uses this concept with a group of believers who have been driven out of their homeland and are now scattered abroad. And he says in James chapter 1, in verse number 2, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. These various tests that take on different forms and shapes and come from different directions, and they're all different sizes, and they're different for different people. But as you face these various trials and temptations and tests, know that the trying, the testing of your faith worketh patience. When we are in a trial, our faith is being tested. Okay, you've said this. You've read it. You've said you believe it. Now, do you really? Does it hold true? Is it firm now in this situation? Your faith is being tested. It's trying the strength or the reality of your faith. We might say that when we are in a trial, our faith is on trial. When we are in a trial, our faith is on trial. The reality of the things confessed are being cross-examined to see if they hold up. When David proved Saul's armor, he was trying it out, testing how well it would work for him. When Israel tempted the Lord, they were putting God on trial. They were cross-examining him, as it were. They were administering a test, seeing if he would pass their examination. Whether he could summon himself to be what, may I put it in my words, they wanted to teach him to be. When they tempted God, they were testing God, putting him on trial. Would he pass their examination? It was an irreverent, humanistic approach that attempted to make God meet their qualifications instead of trusting him, resting on him, and taking him at his word. They had everything turned around, and yet in some ways it may be easier to do than we think. So he says, all those men who have tempted me now these 10 times from the time that they were delivered from Egypt. Let's start in Exodus chapter number 14 this morning. Exodus chapter 14. We're beginning on Sunday nights a series called the Red Sea Rules, and applications taken from the people of Israel at the Red Sea and how to respond appropriately. But we find ourselves here at the story of the Red Sea in Exodus chapter 14 and verse number 10. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord. At first that seemed good. And they said unto Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? Is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt, saying, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. It'd have been better for us to stay in bondage and captivity than for you to cart us out here, bring us into a way of no escape, and just allow us all to die. What good was that? And of course, without faith, without expectation that God could do something, without a reverential, respectful approach to God and crying out to Him, it's a complaint. It's an accusation. And verse 13 shows us the response. And Moses said unto the people, "Fear ye not. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which He will show you today. For the Egyptians whom ye have seen today, ye shall see them again no more forevermore." But what was almost the initial response? They cried out to the Lord, but you have to wonder, was that a prayer? Was it a devout prayer that turned in panic to an accusation? Or was the cry, "What are you doing? Why us?" And of course, then it's directed specifically to the man of God as the physical stand-in, as you will, as the leader for God. Exodus 15 would be this next one I noticed. Exodus 15. And they've now crossed through the Red Sea, seen a tremendous victory, seen the Egyptian army wiped out, and you say, wow, they saw the glory of God in that way, His power, His absolute victory over them. Oh, but only days later now, Exodus chapter 15 and verse 23, and when they came to Marah, they could not drink of the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah. Maybe they named it, oops, oh, this water's gross, it's bitter. Why do we come to bitter? Why do we come to this place? And notice what they did in verse 24. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And he cried unto the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, which when he had cast into the waters were made sweet. Therefore he made them a statute and an ordinance, and there he proved them. He tested them. You see, they're being tested through this, but what they're doing is they're also testing God. They're putting God on trial. "Hey, thought you brought us out here to deliver us. Where's the water? What are you doing? Are you trying to kill us? It'd have been better if we'd have just stayed." And they have no clue. Have you ever seen someone like that? You older believers, even your children, younger people, and they make this wild accusation. "It would have been better." And you think, you have no clue of what you're even talking about. Better? Do you know where you're at? Do you know what I have intended for you? Do you know the direction that we're headed? Do you know the potential and the possibility here? But you think it's better to return? Oh, no. And yet, while we as humans might respond very negatively to an attack like that, and a murmuring and a lack of faith, what did Jesus do? Pointed out a tree, threw the tree in, made the water sweet. There he tested them, it says. Now we go on to chapter 16 of Exodus. Chapter 16, and they took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came unto the wilderness of Sin, which is before Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departing out of the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said unto them, "Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, where we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full. For ye have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Now, are you already kind of seeing a repetition? Like, stop. You're murmuring and complaining and whining and accusing. Now, I have preached here a few weeks back that I think if you look at a cross reference in Deuteronomy, which says that the Lord caused them to hunger and gave them manna, that I think part of their complaint here is based off of an actual feeling of hunger, that their rations are starting to get low, that they just can't have a full meal all the time. And so they're starting to maybe pare down to a couple meals a day, or their portion sizes are getting a little smaller. And we're hungry. And what's the conclusion? Well, we're going to run out of food and die. That's got to be the only conclusion. God can't provide. We're running out of food. We're in the middle of nowhere. And where are we going to get food? We're going to die. And so, again, they murmur and they complain. We remember back in Egypt, remember? Oh, soft glow, angelic voices, you know, when they were sitting by the flesh pots. It makes you, you know, like you're sitting, you know, you're sitting by your big pot of corned beef and we could eat bread to the full. Who wants to do that, you know? But they wanted to do that. It just seemed like, oh. Now, maybe they weren't saying exactly that, but they were saying, well, we might have been in bondage, and it might have been tough, but we had a full meal. We didn't go hungry. We worked hard, but we had something to eat. Now we don't. What's God doing? And they murmured. They murmured. Notice verse number 4. Then said the Lord unto Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no. See now, there's a two-way test going on. I'm testing them. Are you going to obey me or not? Are you going to see who I'm revealing myself to be and follow in the path? Are you going to accept these things or not? But contrary-wise, they're putting God to the test. God's not really meeting their expectations very well. At least he's kind of dragging his feet a little bit. But notice now, he's delivered them from Egypt. We went through the 10 plagues. We've gone through the middle of the Red Sea. We've seen the waters turn sweet. And now he says, I'm going to rain bread from heaven. What? Wow. I mean, has anything ever been heard like that before? No. Has anything been heard like it since? No. Rain bread from heaven. We move to number 4, though, and it has to do with this very issue of this bread rained from heaven. Same chapter, and now we come to verse 19. There were certain regulations as to how much they were to gather, when they were to gather, and it says, and when they gathered it, they were supposed to eat it and not leave of it until the morning. They weren't, in other words, you weren't supposed to have leftovers, and some guys are like, hey, man, like, I don't care, leftovers can be good, but they weren't supposed to have leftovers. God didn't want that. He didn't want them, you know, gathering a bunch of food and then stuffing themselves, oh, man, I'll have this stuff, whatever. He actually, there was a portion control. And they were supposed to eat it, none left over till the morning. Verse 19. And Moses said, let no man leave of it till the morning. Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto Moses, but some of them left of it until the morning, and it bred worms and stank, and Moses was wroth with them. Oh, stop. Who are we dealing with? These are adults. I thought about this illustration. I thought about having Journey come up, you know, and giving her a cup, you know, like a measuring cup. Okay, now, Journey, if I were to give you these instructions and say, now, I want you to go around the lawn, okay, and I want you to pick up the food that God has rained from heaven, right, and is allowed on the lawn, and you pick up a cup. Well, you got a cup, that's what you need. Now, I'm not saying that was the exact measurement that he gave them, but he gave them a specific measure. Gather so much, and rule number 2, don't leave any till the morning. In other words, eat it all tonight. So gather this much and eat it all tonight. It's not rocket science, right? And maybe if we were talking to a 4-year-old, we'd be like, make sure that we're really getting the eye contact and making the English really plain. But we're talking about a nation of over 1 million adults. And he says, don't leave of it until the morning. Some left it until the morning. You know why? Because it's not a matter of intelligence. Because wisdom and foolishness isn't a matter of intelligence, it's a matter of obedience. It's not a matter of the mind, it's a matter of the heart. You can have very intellectual, foolish people, and you can have those who would be considered low on the IQ spectrum that could be wise and could be obedient and submissive to the Lord. So he says, don't leave of it until the morning. And it came to pass, verse 20 there. And notwithstanding, they hearkened not. They didn't listen. They didn't really take it for what it was worth. But some of them left of it until the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was wroth with them. You know, I wonder if they brought out, oh, gross, this bread God gave us stinks, and it's got worms in it. Well, that's what I said. That's what God had told you. Moses was upset. It doesn't really say God's expression here, but it says Moses was wroth with them. Four times now, tempting the Lord, provoking, not obeying. Look at verse 22 of this same chapter. Verse 22. This again was speaking to the gathering of the manna. And it came to pass that on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for one man. And all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. And he said unto them, this is that which the Lord hath said, tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Lord. Bake that which ye will bake today, and seethe that ye will seethe, and that which remaineth over lay up for you to be kept until the morning. Well, now, usually they weren't allowed to do that, but now you could, because this is moving into the Sabbath. So you gather an extra amount, you prepare it for the next day, verse 24, and they laid it up till the morning as Moses bade, and it did not stink, neither was there any worm therein. And Moses said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath unto the Lord. Today ye shall not find it in the field. 6 days ye shall gather it. But on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, in it there shall be none. Does everybody understand that so far? Okay, the seventh day of the Sabbath, you gather twice on the sixth day. Don't do anything on the seventh day. You eat what you gathered on the sixth day. Make sense? Okay, verse 27. And it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day for to gather, and they found none. Well, where's the bread this morning? Where have you been? where did you hear the instructions? And the Lord said unto Moses, how long refuse ye to keep my commandments and my laws? By the way, we kind of tend to think commandments and laws seems like this really big, highfalutin, strict, kind of iron-like bar thing. Ooh, commands and laws. When he tells you to do something, it's a command, and it should be a law. It should govern your life when God says something. So if you sense as a parent, I don't want to be too commanding with my kids. What's your job? Okay, is to set the boundaries, is to give them regulations, is to pass on the structure that God is teaching you to them. And so you say, how long do you violate my commands? And we think maybe something big, like adultery, murder. No, he said, don't gather on the seventh day, and you went out and gathered. How long are you not going to listen to what I say? We could say the same thing, right? To our kids and in our families, God could say the same thing to us sometimes. How long are you not going to obey me? The simple things that I say. Verse 29, see, for that the Lord hath given you the Sabbath, therefore he giveth you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Abide ye every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. They had to learn this Sabbath thing, this resting, that day was unique, that they could gather double, that it wouldn't stink the next day. They would eat from that and rest and remain where they were. So a reminder to observe the Sabbath. Now we come to the sixth time in chapter number 17. And this is going to look a little familiar. Chapter 17, and all the congregation of the children of Israel journeyed from the wilderness of Sin after their journeys according to the commandments of the Lord and pitched in Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Now, does this, like any flashback here? Wait, no water. What did the Lord do? Wherefore the people did chide with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said unto them, why chide ye with me? He understood what it was. Watch. Wherefore do ye tempt the Lord? How is it that you test God again by this lack of belief and telling me what to provide for you? Now, in some ways, were they testing the patience of God? Were they tempting his judgment? Yes. But in some ways, it's like they were putting God on trial again. God's not meeting our expectations. God's not providing what we need. Come on, Moses, get with the program. Moses said, Why do you chide with me? Wherefore do you tempt the Lord? Verse 3, and the people thirsted there for water. And the people murmured against Moses and said, wherefore is this? Oh, here it comes. Wherefore is this that thou hast brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst? Yeah, that's it. No, it's not it. You know, we say ridiculous things when we're upset and when we're grumpy and thirsty, but we got to have faith, right? And Moses cried unto the Lord, saying, what shall I do unto this people? They be almost ready to stone me. Now, does this tell you a little bit about humanity? Not only are we complainers, that we focus on the needs of ourselves to the disbelief of God, but we accuse him of ridiculous things. Why'd you bring us out here to kill us? Really? I mean, did you think that was the plan? No, of course that's not why he brought. And then, how are we going to solve this problem? I mean, we're afraid we're going to die of thirst. I know. Let's stone Moses. That won't bring any more water. I don't see that really solving the problem at all. But because they're so self-absorbed and selfish and their anger raises up and they just want to kill him. Wow. So lest you think this is just sort of like a little temper tantrum or whether, they just kind of forgot. No, I would say in a fleshly way, this is wildly out of control. And their focus is totally on themselves and completely humanistic here. They need to be looking to God, but God's not meeting their needs as he should. They don't have any water to drink. And he says, Lord, what should I do? They want to stone me. Verse 5, and the Lord said unto Moses, go on before the people and take with thee the elders of Israel and thy rod wherewith thou smotest the river. Take in thine hand and go. Behold, I will stand before thee there upon the rock in Horeb. Neat story here. And thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the name of the place Massah. Remember that, Massah and Meribah, because of the chiding of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? That encapsulated their heart. Moses, we're thirsty. We got any water. What are we supposed to drink? Is God among us or not? Do you see the test? If God was here, he'd give us water. Is he here or not? Prove it. Come on. Show us, Moses. God, do your thing. Give us what we want. They put God on a test. And he called the place there Massah. If you turn, hold your place here. And turn over just quickly to Deuteronomy chapter 6, you'll see him reference this situation in the latter years of his leadership there in Deuteronomy chapter number 6 in verse 16. He gives them this short admonition. Deuteronomy 6:16, ye shall not tempt the Lord your God as ye tempted him in Massah. It was like, head on. It was so in your face. Is God among us or not? And so God provided for them. And you notice each time they're putting God on the test, they're putting God to the test. And what does God do? He shows another miracle oftentimes. I'll rain bread out of heaven. I'll split a sea for you. I'll bring birds in that'll fall in the camp for you to eat. I'll have Moses hit a rock and water, a river of water will gush out of it. And so it compounds the problem, it compounds the responsibility. Because not only do they keep putting God to the test, they have more and more miracles and greater glory that they've seen of God. Now they're sinning against more light and more knowledge of who God really is, and yet they keep seeming to come back with the, give us more. Oh, it would be better if only we... It's me again, Lord. Same problem. Now Exodus chapter number 32. Exodus chapter 32 to number 7. Number 7. And I'll kind of summarize the story for you. But let's start off in verse 1 here. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, he was up in the mountain with God, receiving the law, the testimony of the law inscribed by God on stone, but he was there a while. And being there a while, they said to Aaron, up, make us gods, fashion us Elohim, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to become of him. And Aaron said, hey, break off the golden earrings that's in your wife's ears, your daughter's ears, son's ears, and bring them here. Now, later he's going to show us another aspect of humanity that's so true of about every one of us. But he takes all that gold and he melts it down and he fashions it into a calf. And he says, these be thy gods. Now, Benjamin and I were talking the other night about this. This is amazing. That constantly, from the time that they began, that they headed out of Egypt, I don't know exactly what moment when they stepped out of Egypt, but all of a sudden they had something that was totally unique to them as a nation. And they had it for a long time, a daily manifestation of the very presence of God. Remember what it was? There was a cloud. And at night, you remember what it turned into? It turned into a pillar of fire. Could you imagine looking out your tent door over the tabernacle over there, eventually the tabernacle, but for right now, you saw in the middle of the camp, huge pillar of fire. That is not normal. That's the presence of God, our God, the God of Israel, the God who is the I Am, the God who delivered us from Egypt. And yet Moses is in the mountain. They're like, hey, make us a God. Why? We need some visible representation of God. They had it. Every day they had it. They constantly had it, and yet they wanted something different. And now, again, you could float the idea that maybe they were making the calf. They wanted some idol because then they could fashion the religion. They could fashion the worship to what they wanted. Again, it was a self thing. It was trying to conform God to their own lusts and desires. Somebody said, God made man in his image and man returned the favor. You know, we turn around and make God in our image. That's what they were doing here. God tells Moses, the people have corrupted, the holy corrupted themselves. You need to get down off the mount. So he comes down. As they're coming down, Joshua says, oh, man, I hear the noise of war. Oh, whoa, no. And he says, no, it's not the noise of war that I hear. It's the sound of them that sing do I hear. You mean that there's some music that could sound so chaotic and raucous that it sounds like war? Apparently. Yep. I don't think that's probably too foreign to us, is it? And so he mistakes that you see that when their religion changed, when they weren't technically serving a different God, they were just serving him in a different form. They were becoming a little bit more maybe palatable to the nations around them. They looked a little less odd, and so now they had the golden calves, and now Aaron had made them naked to their shame, and now they had music that sounded like war, and Moses comes down and he breaks the tablets of stone, and he takes those golden calves and he grinds them, it says, into powder. He throws it in the water and makes the people drink the water. Wow. But in the process, he says, Aaron, what are you doing? And I'm summarizing here. And Aaron, if you read the text, he says, they wanted me to make them, these gods, and so I took their earrings and I cast them into fire, and out came these calves. Out came these calves. Have you ever gotten a response like that from your kids? How did this happen? Well, it just, yeah, And somehow they end up at like the final result of what happened with all personal agency removed. Like they didn't have any input in that. It just sort of like wrecked itself. You know, I was just standing here and my sister made me sit down, and when I sat down, the couch broke. Oh, interesting how that works. And you see it with a grown adult who's the priest. This calf came out. He's ashamed because as a human, he wants to try to mute his own guilt and try to soften things. So then Moses says, who is on the Lord's side? And the story is interesting because essentially the Levites come to Moses. Now remember, we're only a few months out of bondage here. Again, there's probably 2 to 3 million people. There's 12 tribes, or kind of 13 if you count sons of Joseph in there. But anyway, there's 13, and he says, "Who is on the Lord's side? You guys have distorted this worship. It's wrong. It's wicked. It's evil. And who is on the Lord's side?" And the Levites come. Well, that's kind of a minority, isn't it? And he tells the Levites, he said, "Take your swords and go in and out and slay, essentially, the unrepentant." Now, it's almost surprising that you read in the text that only, I think it was 3,000 were slain. Maybe that's when God said, "Stop. That's enough." But the point is, there was a harsh judgment. Drink the water with the ground up gold. And who's going to follow me? Oh, only the Levites. And so there was a punishment. There was death. There was the loss of life. Doesn't that say something, though, about the heart? That though they had seen the glory of God, they saw miracle after miracle after miracle. They so loved this new worship. They so loved what they had a hold of that when the original leader came down and said, "Who is on the Lord's side?" most of them held on to their death. Isn't that kind of shocking? At least we think it is. Maybe that's because we don't understand the human heart and how desperately wicked it is. Maybe we're not always honest about ourselves and how much we want to hold on to the things that we want, even to the point of destruction in our own lives. That was the seventh time that I see that in some ways they tempted the Lord. They tested the Lord. Now, number 8, we turn over to the book of Numbers. The book of Numbers. And chapter 11, Numbers chapter 11. This time, we don't even read the circumstances. It just goes right to the actions of the people. And you wonder if it, in some ways it was unprovoked in that they weren't hungry or they weren't thirsty per se, but we don't know for sure. Numbers chapter number 11 and verse 1. "And when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, and the Lord heard it, and his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burnt among them and consumed them that were in the uttermost parts of the camp." Very interesting if you read the details and kind of apply your imagination and go, what exactly was the Lord doing? What did this look like? Obviously, you have millions of people. They encamp by households in these, excuse me, in these large tents. And so now you got these tents and you got this encampment and the people start complaining and it starts coming like a ripple through the people. And here it comes again, this selfish heart being verbalized out and murmuring about what God hadn't provided or how hard things were. And God got angry and it said he sent fire and burned up the people in the uttermost part of the camp. It's like the outside edges. What did that look like? Was it a wall of fire moving in? All of a sudden, this wall of fire started moving in and just burning people and tents and their things? I'm not for sure exactly, but it's interesting to think about. But the fire of the Lord burnt among them, it says, and consumed them that were in the uttermost part of the camp. And the people cried unto Moses. And when Moses prayed unto the Lord, the fire was quenched. And he called the name of the place Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burnt among them. You know, I'm not against you asking people for prayer, right? Well, there was a day not too long ago, and I texted about four or five people that I needed prayer because I was just struggling in a tough spot for that particular day. It's good to have people that you know will pray. But when people, they live a life that's so self-consumed and selfish and selfish, and finally they begin to get burned up by the consequences. Oh, Moses! Oh! And I don't mean to make an exact correlation from Moses to the pastor, but from our vantage point, we could say, oh, pastor, solve the problem! Well, in this case, Moses certainly could pray, and he had that relationship with the Lord, and it did stop the anger of God. But look, why don't we just govern our lives so that we don't have to cry out to stop the consequences? Let's just live in such a way that we experience the blessings of God and not the consequences. You understand what I'm saying? Instead of waiting until half of our tent is burnt up, we've just lost our baby in the fire, and go, oh, Moses, stop, please! Why then? Now, better then than never. But why not just humble ourselves? Stop putting God to the test. Start living the way he wants us to live and saying, God, you're the ruler. You're the one whose presence I see with me every day. You're the one who delivered us. You have a purpose and a plan for us, and we're destined for the promised land. And I just want to be yours. I want to obey you. Now we continue on to verse number 4. They've just had this burning. They've lost some things to the fire. And verse number 4 says, and the mixed multitude. We presume that the mixed multitude was, when they were in Egypt, there may have been some Egyptians along the way that said, this God is powerful. And to whatever degree sensed that this is the God, at least the most powerful God. And wow, if I'm going to, you know, if I'm going to throw my hat in the ring here, I think maybe it's with these people. I mean, our country's being destroyed here. Pharaoh's letting the thing be demolished. I think I'm just going to leave with these folks. So we don't know exactly how many might have left that were Egyptians natively, but followed along with the people of Israel. Were they believers in Jehovah? Not necessarily. Not to the core. So as they went along, would they have the same? Would they have their own heathen desires? Would they have their own polytheistic baggage? Would they have their own designs and thoughts? Would they understand the history of Israel and the promises to which God was leading them? Not necessarily. It's a dangerous mix, and the mixed multitude that was among them fell a lusting. And the children of Israel also wept again and said, who shall give us flesh to eat? Sometimes we're negatively impacted by the people that are with us. And these people fell to lusting. Oh, man, you know what I so miss about Egypt? You know, oh, I would give anything for like some fried chicken. Oh, man, it would be so good. Like this bread stuff, you know, so, I mean, I'm not, you know, it's okay. But I mean, can he not do any better, really? I mean, if this God's so, like, couldn't we have meat? Oh, it's just so nice to have some meat. And then children, yeah, you know, now that you say something, that's true. That would be really good. And oh, who shall give us flesh to eat? Who could do that? Well, I bet I know somebody if you asked him and if it was his will. We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, and the onions, and the garlic. Remember the old barbecues we had in the backyard when we weren't slaving away and being whipped to death because we couldn't build Pharaoh's cities fast enough? Yeah, no, but they seem to remember the good food and the selection they had. Remember the Super Walmart? Oh, yes. Okay. Well, it's changed now. And it says, but now, verse 6, our soul is dried away. Our soul is dried away. Time and time again, you've seen the working of God. You're delivered out of the bondage of Egypt. You have his presence literally floating right above you. He drops bread out of heaven every day. He produced a river out of a rock. He led you through a sea, and your soul is dried away. There is nothing at all beside this manna before our eyes. Oh, nothing except this is what God's given us here. Except that. Yeah, the thing that's been holding body and soul together. The thing that's totally sufficient to carry you on day by day. Yeah. But the good stuff isn't there because people were lusting, wanting more. And then he describes the manna that was there. But look at verse 11. And Moses said unto the Lord, wherefore hast thou afflicted thy servant? Wherefore have I not found favor in thy sight that thou layest the burden of all this people upon me? Have I conceived all this people? Have I begotten them that thou shouldest say unto me, carry them in thy bosom, as a nursing father beareth a sucking child unto the land which thou swearest unto their fathers? Whence should I have flesh to give unto all this people? For they weep unto me, saying, give us flesh that we may eat. I'm not able to bear all the people alone, because it's too heavy for me. And if thou deal thus with me, kill me, I pray thee, out of hand. Lord, these people are too much for me. I can't take this anymore. And if you're not going to take them away, kill me. Oh, brought the leader to such stress and pressure. What a downward spiral. What a negative environment. What a demoralizing place to be. And so, guess what? God showed him another miracle. You want flesh? You want meat? I'll give you meat. And he gave them flesh, and birds flew in. They were stacked up, and oh, whoa, look at that. Yeah, good job, God. Way to do it. And they could pluck those birds and cook them over the fire. And I want you to turn to Psalm 106, as you contemplate that picture in your mind. Psalm 106, verse 14. Verse 13 says, they soon forgat his works. Verse 14, but lusted exceedingly in the wilderness and tempted God in the desert. And he gave them their request, but sent leanness into their soul. As one person said, they got what they wanted, but lost what they had. What they said they had, oh, this our soul is dried away. By the time they were done, they had leanness of soul. God, as the meat was in their mouth, here came the judgment. As they were feeding their lust and eating their meat and gorging themselves on the thing they thought they wanted, God smote them with a plague. And Moses named the place Kibroth Hatteavah. They were the graves of lust. That was number 9. And now we come to Numbers chapter 12. Numbers 13. Numbers 12, if you look at it, is another maybe temptation, you'd say, but it's not a national temptation. It's Aaron and Miriam specifically disobeying there or sinning. But in the 10th time here that we're looking at is in Numbers chapter 13. And we finally made it to the promised land. That is, we're on the edge. We could pass over, and in Numbers 13 and verse 26, Moses, actually start off at the beginning of the chapter. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, send thou men, that they may search the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel. Of every tribe of their fathers shall ye send a man, every one a ruler among them. So go in and spy out the land. See the people, see the condition of the land, see their cities, and bring back the fruit, okay? Now, look at verse 26 as we come. The spies have gone throughout the land. They come back, and they say in verse 26, they went and came to Moses and to Aaron, to all the congregation of the children of Israel, unto the wilderness of Paran to Kadesh, and brought back word unto them and unto all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told him and said, we came unto the land whither thou sentest us, and surely it floweth with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it. Ooh, wow, this is going to be great. Verse 28, nevertheless, the people be strong that dwelt in the land, and the cities are walled and very great. And moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. If you don't remember what that is, Goliath was a son of Anak. They were giants, okay, Anak and his sons. The children of Anak were there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and the Hittites and the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and by the coast of Jordan. And they were starting to, oh no, these people are big. They're big, and they're walled cities, and I don't know if we can do this. In verse 30, Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it. But the men that went up with him said, we be not able to go up against the people, for they're stronger than we. And they brought up an evil report of the land which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, the land through which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof, and all the people that we saw in it are men of great stature. Now you see the exaggeration. And there we saw giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so were we in their sight. Assumption. Okay, so of course you see doubt, exaggeration, assumption, and the decline. Now the problem is that in all this, they crossed over their jurisdiction. That wasn't their job. Their job wasn't to say, "Do you think we should do this?" Okay, guys, you're going to be the joint chiefs of staff here, and after you take a look at the land, just tell us whether you think with the power of God we could do this or not, because, yeah. I don't think that, even if you read the text and he says, look at the cities, look at the people, look at the condition of the land, I don't think you can walk away and understand what God was doing with the people of Israel and expect that their job was to give a recommendation as to whether they could do it. That's a foregone conclusion. That's why God's brought you here. Again, to rehash it all, a miracle after miracle after miracle after miracle you've seen the power of God. He devastated the world power of Egypt, and now it's up to you to fight your way into the promised land. But they go, oh, no, we can't do it. We can't do it. The people are too big. Since when did that become an issue? Do you remember a few months ago when you were sitting in your house as God wreaked havoc on Egypt? Do you remember that? But now the people are too big. We're just so small and we're incompetent. There's no way we would measure up to that. We be not able, and they brought up an evil report of the land. And so, the Lord promises that they, the unbelieving adults of that generation, 20 and above, would not get to go into the promised land. But now they had condemned themselves to almost 40 years of wandering in that wilderness. No, they wouldn't cross the river. No, they wouldn't breach those walls. No, they wouldn't attack those peoples and see victory. No, not until everyone, every adult, unbelieving, is dead, and only Joshua and Caleb remain, and the next generation, to go and see the victory which you doubted God to deliver to you. And so we end up at Numbers chapter 14 and verse 22. Because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have tempted me now these 10 times and have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers. Neither shall any of them that provoked me see it. No, God is forgiving. God is a gracious God, and he's compassionate. But you have to wonder, at what point of disbelieving, at what point of resisting God again and of pushing him away, am I sacrificing my family and my future and all these possibilities. They're eroding. My doubt is drawing them, if you will, into the sea of life and saying, oh, I can't do that. Oh, God's not meeting my needs here. Oh, and what am I teaching my kids? And what am I doing about the promises of God as I continue to let my doubt and my accusation against God erode away at the things that he wants to do? At a certain point, he said to them, okay, brought you this far? 10 times you've put me to the test. And that's enough. You're not going into the land. We may blame Israel. And it's easy for us to do. We look into Scripture. Oh, Peter, my goodness, but Peter had such a big mouth. Oh, Israel, I mean, they just kept complaining and complaining and complaining. But if our temptations of God were recorded for humanity, 2,000 years into the future and more, 4,000, would we do much better if our lives were put on display? I don't think the question is, have you tempted God? The question to ask now is, are you tempting God? Are you trying his patience? Are you putting him to a test? God, are you among us or not? Are you going to give me what I want or not? Are you putting him on trial? Parading around as a child of God, but complaining, accusing, skeptical of his promises, and ignoring his very presence. Are we wanting God to measure up to our plan? Or are we submitting to his plan? Let's train our thinking right now by reminding ourselves that he is the all-wise God. He is love. He is the Almighty. He is the sovereign creator, designer, definer, sustainer. He is good all the time. That's who God is. Regardless of what we see around us, how hungry we may feel, and the fact that maybe we're a little thirsty. Whether we're up against the Red Sea and between sword and sea, as one person put it. We don't doubt who God is. We submit and we cry out to him sincerely, God, what to do now? We will find the peace we need, not when God meets our conditions, but when we conform to his design. Do you today need to confess to God that you've been putting him to a test? You've been making him prove himself by your standards. And you say, God, I'm sorry. Realize that. That's not my place. I don't want to tempt you. I'm not the judge. You're the judge, and I'm your child. And God, I'm asking you today to forgive me and teach me your way.